Hi everybody, if everybody's settled, shall we start? You'll see up there, I was going to announce this, but it's gone. I've taken it off, that's why. The next lecture I'll be giving in these lectures will be Wednesday 18th of November, so I've got to be away next Wednesday, so there won't be a lecture next week, but the next lecture's the 18th. That's actually the final lecture this term, and then there are four more next term. Can I also just announce something else? That is, we're very keen to get suggestions from you. I mean, basically positive suggestions about things that could be done to improve things around the school. I know there are many such things, but we had a scheme last year. It was very successful. We got a lot of very good ideas. If I could mention, there are three suggestion boxes around the school. There's one at the main entrance when you come into this old building. There's one in the brunch bowl, which is going there. And apparently there's one in the lobby of St. Clement's building as well. And you could also send email suggestions to Paul Nancarrow. That's N-A-N-C-A-R-R-O-W. N-A-N-C-A-R-R-O-W. P. Nancarrow. P is in the email directory. His room is 8606. I would encourage people to send us particularly positive suggestions, which even about minor things that might help in everyday life, you know. We did make some quite good changes on the basis of suggestions that people had last year. I know you can make all sorts of daffy suggestions as well, like close the whole place down, that kind of thing, but it would be good to have some positive ones if you... especially as you go through the year, if you think of things, well, this is one suggestion, keep the lights working. Who did that? I didn't do that, did I? Someone coming in must have done that. Well, not working up there. Well, I presume the lights will come up the top as well in a sec. Where we got to last time? Origins of socialism. Marx is the key figure in the development of socialism. Karl Marx was one of those people who never had any doubts, it seems. He wasn't a tortured personality. Even though he lived in poverty, Marx seems always to have believed in his mission. He wasn't successful in his own lifetime, as I mentioned last time. He didn't really have a big body of followers until afterwards. But he never seems to have had any doubt about his impact on history. And that impact he certainly did have. I think it's absolutely central as we go through these lectures that you keep in mind, well, thanks very much, that we keep in mind that Marx set out to change the world. What Marx was trying to do, and in a way what the whole of the socialist tradition is trying to do, is not just study the world, but use an interpretation of history to change history. The lead theorem of Marx, which is really the theorem that ties him to the Enlightenment, because this was the particular position of the Enlightenment, we have to understand history to change history. Only if we understand our past, and if we understand that in the past, human beings have lived history without controlling history. History has controlled us rather than us controlling it. We need to switch around, Marx says. We need to become masters of our own history. We can only do that through understanding it. So when you ask why Marxism has had so much impact on the world, I suggested last time as well, there are two aspects to this. One is stress on the union of theory and practice. The philosophers interpreted the world, the point is to change the world. Is that kind of quasi-religious aspect of Marx and Marxism that was certainly important in the impact it's made on world history. But the second thing is the sheer intellectual power of Marx's interpretation of history. And it was this intellectual scheme that I was describing last time. Now, Marx argued that there are certain distinctive forms of society in history, and you can't understand, as it were, the potentialities open to us today living in an industrial civilization, if you don't understand how history has changed and what possibilities it's offered. So let's look fairly quickly at this scheme, because this has also had a lot of impact on historians and others. Marx argues the earliest kind of society, not a very good thing, hold on, is what he calls tribal society. And he had another term for this that I'll come onto in a minute. Tribal society is the earliest form of human society, what anthropologists call hunting and gathering societies, or small agricultural communities. The whole of human social life originated in this form of society. Now, Engels, who worked closely with Marx, remember, had a particular term for tribal society. He called it primitive communism. Primitive communism. By that he meant, and Marx meant, that in the smaller types of agricultural community and hunting and gathering societies, most things tend to be owned in common. Remember, the origin of communism is communal. These were communal-based societies. So that, for example, in hunting and gathering cultures, there was virtually no private property. Nearly everything was owned in common by the members of the tribe. And you find even among surviving such groups today, there aren't many, but there are a few. Say if you go on a hunt or something, you kill a pig, let's say, it isn't yours. The pig belongs to the community. You might get the best bit, the eyeballs or the testicles or something, but you would have to give the rest of it to the community. The fruits of hunting, like other activities, are communal activities. Primitive communism, as communism or communal ownership of property, however, based upon poverty. In Marx's view, this was a non-class society. It's a fundamental thing of Marx's ideas and socialist ideas more generally, I suppose, that class division are not natural. They're not given in history. They develop from history, and they can be changed by history. These are societies with only a low level of inequality. However, Marx argued, quite rightly, I think, that this low level of inequality is based upon poverty. The reason why there aren't class divisions in these societies is that they simply live close to the breadline and there isn't enough to go round. That's why they're sort of forced to share production communally. Primitive communism, therefore, is a classless society, but it's a classless society based upon lack of wealth. As we'll see in a minute, Marx argued that a classless society of the future would be the opposite. It will be based upon abundance rather than poverty. Now, there's a very important thing here. Marx was not an admirer of primitive communism. Marx was not an admirer of the traditional local rural community. Famously, one of his sort of more polemic phrases talks of rural idiocy. In other words, kind of limited nature of culture in these societies, rural idiocy. This is very important because this is a division within socialism. Marx had no time really for the small agrarian community. Many other socialists built their ideas around it, and especially anarchists built their ideas around it. What they wanted to see was an escape from industrialism. This is still quite common today. It was very common in the student movements of the 1960s, for example, 30 or so years ago. The idea that industrialism is something which is basically oppressive and we need to escape from it back into the local rural community. Many people have thought that. And whole branches of socialist anarchist thought were based on that. That means escaping from industrial society, going back to an earlier form of production. Well, Marx never had any time for that. Marx was extremely hostile to people who thought in that way. This is, again, very important. Marx was not a critic of industrialism. Marx thought that industrialism, for reasons I'll mention very shortly, generates far more wealth than any other society or culture has ever had before. The problem is to use industrial production rationally so as to produce a society where that wealth is reasonably evenly distributed and where it's used for human purposes rather than the endless pursuit of profit, a question which still makes sense at the end of the 20th century as it did, I think, at the end of the 19th century. So the first type of society in history for Marx is something we have to escape from. If you want to put it in sort of current terms, you could say Marx was a modernizer, because Marx thought that modernization or transformation, getting away from our rural past, was the key to living a decent life in the future. Now, Marx's scheme of history looks, roughly speaking, like this. He argues that in Europe, out of tribal society, you get the first class system. This is the ancient societies of Greece, Rome, and the other civilizations I mentioned last time, the early agrarian civilizations. These are class societies in the sense in which, since they accumulate more wealth, since they're urban-based civilizations, you get a class division. Basically, you get a fairly complicated class division, but basically a class division between a patrician or aristocratic ruling class and a majority class of slaves and other non-propertied individuals. This is a class system, Marx thought, based upon slavery. Slaves of Greece, slaves of Rome especially, he had in mind. And this is a kind of society in which the class division is structured around ownership of people. In a slave-owning society, some people literally own other people. They don't do that in a modern society. There is a big difference in being in a labor market, Marx thinks, and being owned by anybody. Slavery, Marx thought, is not a very economically efficient mode of production. So, what happened in the ancient world, Marx argued, was that there were class conflicts between the dominant class and the slaves and other groups. You have numerous slave revolts. Most people here would have heard of Spartacus and the Spartacus slaves revolt, but there were many revolts of the slaves. So this was a society in which there was a lot of conflict. But this conflict, Marx argues, did not lead to, as it were, a higher stage of civilization. The reason for this is that slavery, Marx says, was an insuperable barrier to further economic development. So in Rome, for example, you had quite a lot of commerce, you had quite a lot of trade, but it never led to a capitalist society. What it led to was a society which destroyed itself through its own contradictions. You can't have a commercial society, Marx argues, based upon slavery, because slavery is too static, it's too fixed, it doesn't fit with an industrial society. You could argue the same thing happened all over again in the American Civil War, and that's just what Marx did argue in his writings on America, that the Civil War was a war between two systems of production. To have an effective industrial society, you had to get rid of slavery. It was less motivated by noble values and by the economic need to have a more flexible labor force. To put the story in brief anyway, since I don't have time to tell it in detail, the ancient world collapsed under the impress of its own structural contradictions or difficulties. So the barbarians marching into Rome were simply putting a seal upon an already declining and decaying civilization. Edward Gibbon, the famous historian of Rome, reached much the same conclusion. Max Weber, a famous German sociologist, drew very strongly on Marx's analysis in his discussion of the ancient world. And there are several very prominent ancient historians who still use this analysis as a way of explaining why the ancient world, why Rome in particular, collapsed. In Europe, this leads to, of course, the emergence of feudalism, the transformation of feudalism into capitalism is something I discussed last time, so I won't go over it again. It involves the same kind of scheme, except in this case you get an historical progression. Feudalism begins as a decentered agrarian system involving a system of obligation and fealty between an aristocratic ruling class and an enserfed peasantry. As a result of its economic development, you get the emergence of urban centers, these become manufacturing centers, you don't have the barrier of slavery, this develops a bourgeoisie or a new manufacturing capital-based class. This class eventually challenges the old feudal class, overthrows it, and so you get the French Revolution and a sequence of so-called bourgeois revolutions. The bourgeois revolutions are the manufacturing class in the towns putting political power on top of their economic power. You get an economic transformation of feudalism, followed by a political revolution, followed by ideological, or bound up with ideological transformation. We think, for example, so much in terms of individualism, Marx says, because individualism was what the new emerging class wanted. They wanted to hire and fire workers. Well, you couldn't do that in a feudal system. Feudalism was possible to get beyond, as it were, in a way in which slavery wasn't, however. Feudalism leads to our type of society, industrial capitalism, and I'll be saying more about that in a minute. Industrial capitalism, according to Marx, will eventually be superseded by socialism, which puts, as it were, the cap on this historical evolution. We need to look in some detail about what this transition actually is. However, here's something really interesting, and again, had a lot of influence. Marx argues that this is a pattern of Europe. There is no inevitability about it. This is simply the history of Europe. And in the East, and in the other big civilizations, something different happens. So when you think of China or India, Marx wrote quite extensively about China and India. In China and India, you get a different pattern of development. And here you get what Marx sometimes called Oriental despotism. He didn't invent this term, but he sometimes used it. Or the Asiatic mode of production. By this, he meant traditional China, India, and although he wrote less on it, Japan. What happens in the East, Marx argues, is you get a kind of arrested case of class development. These societies never became full class societies in the way in which Rome and the ancient world did in Europe. The reason for this, certainly in China and India, was that they were big land masses. As they kind of developed economically, so they developed a sort of early state, a kind of administrative system, the Chinese imperial state, for example. The Chinese imperial state kind of froze out further class development, Marx argues, because it wasn't too favorably inclined to commerce. So these societies remain sort of suspended as being half-class societies, yet not fully class societies. And they were societies in which irrigation, control of irrigation by an early bureaucratic state, came to introduce a kind of stability into history. Again, Marx says a lot more about that than I can really say here, but the essence of his argument is that in the East, you get a kind of accommodation or balance between a central state apparatus and a relatively primitive but quite well organized system of production centered around irrigation. He argues that therefore these societies are relatively static, for some 2,000 years. In these societies, you don't get the same dynamic of development as happened in the West. These are societies, if you like, ruled by a bureaucratic elite rather than a class. Now, there are plenty of people, again, who picked up on this theme. If I put it in a little box, one important writer here was a famous historian called Karl Fittfogel, who wrote an equally famous book called Oriental Despotism, in which he uses Marx's ideas, to discuss the Eastern civilizations. But this is one of the intriguing things about it. It's also relevant to Marx. Wittfogel tried to apply this then to Russia. What Wittfogel argued was that Russia was itself a case of Oriental despotism, a bureaucratic state of an authoritarian kind, and that when communism was established there, communism kind of picked up on this authoritarian system. So that according to Wittfogel, and according to a lot of interpreters of the Soviet Union, Soviet communism, strangely enough, using Marx, became a kind of transmuted authoritarian state. It simply kept on the same kind of authoritarianism, of despotism, as was true of previous periods. It's a thesis worth looking at, and we'll consider it in a bit more detail in the next lecture when I discuss why communism collapsed and what's happened to socialism after Marx. But this book had a lot of influence. It's very important in Marx's terms because you have to ask, did Marx regard Russia as a case of Oriental despotism or not? The answer is we don't really know. Marx did, however, say some very important things about Russia and the possibility of revolution there, which we'll come on to a bit later. Now, Marx's argument is that these societies, in a sense, don't have a history. In Europe, you have a dynamic history. In Asia, you don't. You have more stasis. So what happens is that these societies only become transformed through the globalizing impact of Western capitalism. It's only when Western capitalism expands across the world and the adventurers, the merchants from the West go to China, go to Japan, go to India, start to colonize India, that these civilizations start to crumble. They crumble because they're not prepared for this contact. They're based on a completely different system. So when they come into contact with Western colonialism, it's highly destructive. And it essentially undermines, eventually, the old system of production, or will do so completely. So these societies are brought into world history by the impact of industrial capitalism, which, for reasons I'll go on to discuss immediately, Marx says is a voraciously expanding system. Industrial capitalism is different, he's quite right about this, from traditional civilizations. For example, the Chinese, even as late as the 17th century, were well ahead of Europe. But the imperial rulers decided not to expand into the wider world. At a certain point, famously, they stopped exploration occurring. They said you must retreat within the walls of the Chinese Empire. In the West, this did not happen. The reason it did not happen, Marx argues, is that the dynamics of capitalism make it impossible. There are certain reasons as to why capitalism cannot stay still. It's not a society that can stay still. We all know this from our own lives. If you think of the changing rate of technology today, as soon as you buy a computer, it's obsolete. Well, there's never been a society remotely like that in history. It is a society of endless change. And it's a society of endless expansion. So the whole world history changes, Marx argues, once industrial capitalism becomes established. So let's look at his analysis of industrial capitalism, what it is, and how it supposedly becomes transformed into socialism. Because in a way, this is a core of what Marx's writings were all about. What is a capitalist economy, and what capitalist industrial society? Here, Marx is talking about the kind of society we live in today. I think no one disputes that capitalism is still the key term for designating the kind of economy and society in which we live, especially with the collapse of the Soviet Union. No one any longer denies that capitalism is a globalizing system. Anyone who's followed the trajectory of East Asia, Asian economies, can see the globalization, the capitalist economy, and the fact that it increasingly draws us all within a single global marketplace. Well, Marx anticipated most of that, although he thought there would be a strong reaction against it. And indeed, for quite a long historical period, there was a strong reaction against it in the shape of the ideas that Marx promoted. So what is this kind of society? Where does it get its dynamism from? What's it doing to the world? A capitalist society, of course, depends on the accumulation of capital. And there's never been a society before, Marx argues, of this type. In pre-modern societies, you had merchants, you had commerce. You never had a whole society based upon market principles. Capital means the accumulation of wealth, which is reinvested to produce more wealth. In a capitalist economy, money is not static. Anything can be bought and sold. Capital, whether it's in the form of money, whether it's in the form of ownership of factories, whether it's in the form of ownership of machines, whether it's in the form of ownership of other fluid assets, capitalism is a regularized investment system whereby you invest money in other resources to try to generate further resources. A fundamental aspect of capitalist economy, therefore, Marx says, is the existence of the commodity. Again, something pretty unique in history. We are the first type of economy and society in which almost everything can be bought and sold. A commodity is simply anything bought and sold on the marketplace. Marx argues that in a capitalistic society, for the first time, for example, take one example, land can be bought and sold. We're so familiar with this at the end of the 20th century that no one thinks it's at all surprising. You can sell your house, you can sell the land, your house is on, you can sell your farm, whatnot. You couldn't, of course, do so in a feudal system. You couldn't do so in most pre-modern societies. Lots of land was non-alienable. You couldn't sell it. Basically, in a capitalist society, you believe there is a price for everything, and the price is determined not by the intrinsic use of the asset, but by how much you can get for that asset on a market. So the idea of a commodity in turn implies a market, and it implies an indefinitely extensible market, as it were, because as more and more things become turned into commodities, so markets occupy more and more of our lives. So that now we live in a society where you can assess easily and immediately the cost of going on a holiday against the cost of buying a new item of clothing. Well, these things have nothing in common whatsoever. Just used to doing it because that's what a market does for us. A market creates abstract value in terms of which, you can compare and price anything. And Marx thought this also included human beings. Fundamental aspect of modern capitalism is that labor power, that is you and I, also becomes a commodity. In a capitalist society, again, for the first time in history, if you want to put it this way, you have labor markets. the labor market is where all of us here sell our labor in order to get a return. No one here, I take it, lives from the produce of their own small plot of land. We all depend upon a whole series of services which we purchase through the money we can get, whether as a student getting a grant, whether a person getting a job in the labor market. Human labor power, therefore, becomes a commodity to be bought and sold like any other commodity. And if you consider capitalist or industrialist, you know, making a decision about investment, that capitalist can simply assess whether or not the labor costs are too high in relation to the cost of technology or the cost of the plant or whatever. Labor power, therefore, Marx says, is a sort of dehumanizing of human beings because it treats human beings as though they were equivalent to material objects, simply to be bought and sold at the whim of industrialists or other employers. And he had a lot to say about that. This is the nub, therefore, of the class system of capitalism. The class system of capitalism looks roughly like this. You have a dominant class of industrialists, or they're the owners of large capital. They're people who own large enterprises, banks, finance companies, and so on. You have a large class of people who have only their labor power to sell, in other words, a working class, or Marx sometimes used a more archaic terminology, bourgeoisie and proletariat, but you can roughly ignore that, largely ignore that. It's an industrial dominant class. There is a majority of the population working, selling their labor to that class. In the middle, you have many other groups. For example, you have small property owners, small capital, people who Marx also called the petty bourgeoisie. These are people who own small businesses. They're often in conflict with the owners of large capital in a capitalistic society. So according to Marx's analysis, a capitalist society has an economic base, which is the expansion of markets. It has political institutions, which are parliamentary democracy. And it has an ideology. That ideology is individualism. The ideology of capitalism is the idea that we're all responsible for our own individual fate. We should all get on with our own individual lives. We have to look to ourselves for our own economic reward and our own salvation. Very, very different from a feudal system, Marx argues. Now, this society, according to Marx, should follow the same plan that I mentioned last time. That is, you have an existing set of relations of production. You have a new set of relations of production developing within that society on an economic level, which will eventually lead to a period of revolution, and after that, a new kind of society taking over. And this is exactly what Marx tried to show. Marx argues that in its early years, a capitalist society is based upon open market competition between lots of producers and consumers. In the early period of a capitalist society, producers and consumers know nothing about one another. You're producing for a market. You only know whether you should go on producing in terms of whether people buy your product. Marx thought this was very, very different from a feudal system. In a feudal system, you knew who you were producing for. In a feudal system, there is a connection between production and consumption, because if there is a market, it's a very local market. The farmers go into the market. They know who they're producing for, the local villagers. In a capitalist society, for the first time, there is a massive split between production and consumption, and only the market determines the relationship between one and the other. It's only in terms of price investment and profit that industrialists will go on producing only so long as people buy what they actually produce. So a schism or a division is introduced between production and consumption. In the early phases of capitalism, then, you have no kind of conscious intervention in the production process. It is simply a society dominated by market forces. It's a heavily revolutionary society. It can't stay still, Marx says, precisely because you've always got to be looking for new markets. There is no way in which a capitalist enterprise can simply stay stable. There are technical reasons for this, which Marx gave, but he argues that in a capitalist economy, you must always try and get new markets, you must always try and cheapen your labor power, you must always try and cheapen your costs to compete with other producers. So capitalism involves massive processes of technological change. It's a society in which technological change is absolutely fundamental, because if you can introduce a specific technological change, you can get a market for a while until someone catches up with you. It's also a society which ruthlessly expands into the rest of the world, because the more you can get cheap raw materials, the more you can get cheap labor power, the more you can compete more effectively with other people competing with you in the marketplace. Capitalism, therefore, is a system based upon what Marx calls the anarchy of the market, the anarchy of the market in its early phases. You're still here sort of at the beginning of this process. Now, as capitalism expands, Marx argues, two changes occur on the economic level. First of all, you get the increasing concentration of capital. And second, you get the increasing centralization of capital. Concentration of capital means that capitalism, although it begins as an open market system, tends towards the production of monopoly or oligopoly in the organization of industrial enterprise. What this means, put simply, is that capitalism is an erratic kind of system. It goes through crises of underproduction or overproduction of the kind we're now seeing perhaps in the global economy. In these crisis situations, big firms can prosper, while small firms tend to go out of business. So capitalism tends to produce a system in which a limited number of very big firms tend to dominate the economy. These are big firms like, in our day, General Motor or ICI or the many other really big firms that dominate the world economy. That's the concentration of capital. The centralization of capital means the emergence of banks, especially central banks, which seek to regulate the system. Centralization of capital means that you don't just accept the marketplace. Banks, for example, today, as we will be seeing in the course of today, use interest rates as a way of trying to stabilize the capitalist economy. And we'll know today what the Bank of England decided to do about that. Now, the importance of these processes is that as they continue, as you get more concentration and centralization of capital, you're going up this line here, you're producing a contradiction at the heart of capitalism. Because these are forms of production based upon conscious control. They're no longer just based upon open anarchic competition. Big firms can control the markets that they're in, and banks and other organizations, including the state, can increasingly control the economy. As this happens, capitalism is subverting itself, Marx argues, because what this is showing is the emergence of socialism within capitalism. What is socialism? Well, socialism is organizing production consciously according to human need. Capitalist markets do not do that. But increasingly, as big firms dominate, so you get a kind of introduction of conscious control back into the economy. It's not socialism, certainly not socialism. In some respects, Marx argues it's the most aggressive form of capitalism, but it's no longer the old system. Even on a world scale, you get big corporations that can command large sectors of the economy. And of course, in our day, they can do so through advertising and many other characteristics. This is socialism struggling to emerge from capitalism, Marx says. It's the system transforming itself from within on an economic level. It gives us the chance of using the fruits of industrial production much more effectively than they can be in an anarchic, open, competitive market system. It's still, however, capitalism. Now, when you get economic change, you would expect to get political change, and you would expect to get ideological change. That's what the model involves. And this is exactly, Marx says, what happened. As the system becomes socialized, as the fact, you know, emerges that we're actually all interdependent in a modern economy, the system can't just depend upon individualism because we're much more interdependent than we ever were before. As this happens economically, on the political level, you get the rise of a political reaction to this, which is the rise of organized labor movements and political parties. The emergence of labor parties or socialist parties is the political expression of an understanding of the inherently social nature of the world which industrial society is creating. So you get, first of all, a kind of defensive formation of organized labor, and then you get the politicization of organized labor. You get labor or socialist parties emerging in all countries, setting up to challenge the existing parties that were there hitherto. And this is indeed what happened. With the arguable exception of the United States, in every Western country, a socialist party or parties, or labor party or parties, did develop. Marx thought they could be the agents of significant transformation of the system. On an ideological level, socialism and Marxism itself is the ideological expression of these changes. There are a lot of questions to be asked about whether Marxism itself simply became an ideology of class domination in the Soviet Union. But certainly Marx argued that the emergence of socialism and indeed communism, a set of ideas, is the ideological arm of these things. So this eventually he expected to lead to revolution, get a process of revolution which would transform capitalism and produce a very different type of society. How and why would this happen? Well, Marx thought in some societies, like for example the UK, he mentioned, remember he was laboring in the library here, in Holland, one or two other countries with established parliamentary traditions, you could just get a reformist process of socialism. Socialist parties would come to power, they'd be able to reform the system, they would nationalize industry, they would reintroduce conscious control of economic life. Because Marx saw socialism as introducing the possibility of production again for need. It's true in a primitive context, it can be true in an advanced context. Rather than price and profit, why don't we use the fruits of industrial production to produce what we know we need? As Marx thought, remember, that capitalism was irrational. Capitalism is not the best way to make use of the fruits of industrial production. Because in a capitalist system, you can have millions of people without shoes, you can have factories producing shoes which lie idle. Marx thought it was absurd to have a society with large numbers of unemployed when there are plenty of needs for whom, if people were employed, they could cater. A socialist society would therefore reintroduce a connection between production and human need. It would humanize capitalism, if you like. Some countries this could happen as a reformist process, but elsewhere, Marx said, it would have to happen through revolution. This is where, in a way, we get back full circle, because towards the end of his life, Where did Marx start writing about? Where did Marx think the revolution might occur? Well, Russia. In the last few years of his life, Marx was in active correspondence with Russian socialists, and Marx spent some time studying Russian society. Marx argued that Russia would be the sparking point for revolution. Indeed, that's what happened, of course, in the October 1917 revolution in Russia, about 30 or so years after Marx died. However, in this correspondence of letters with Russian socialists, Marx argued this can only be an effective revolution if it becomes generalized. The reason why revolution might happen in Russia, Marx thought, is you get a clash of advancement and backwardness. As technology, as ideas become imported from Western Europe into Russia, it's an explosive mix. Russia, therefore, could be a sparking point for revolution, but revolution could only be successful, Marx argued, and here he must have had in mind the Asian mode of production or Oriental despotism, could only become successful if it was transported back to Western Europe. Only if Russia became a sparking point for a European revolution, Marx thought, could a socialist revolution become successful. You couldn't jump from a peasant society to a socialist one. This is not, as you'll know, what history produced. What happened was that the revolution in Russia did occur. It did occur upon much the same lines as Marx had anticipated. It did produce the first Marxist society in history, but for some 40 or so years, that society was the only Marxist or socialist society in the world. And so what happened was that Stalin, the first inheritor of this society, invented the doctrine of socialism in one country. By socialism in one country, he meant what Marx seemingly had prohibited. You could have a successful transition from a largely agrarian society to an advanced socialist industrial one. Many other people, including socialists, doubted this. And this became the main division between orthodox Marxism or Marxist-Leninism. Lenin, of course, was the originator of the 1917 revolution, between this orthodoxy on the one hand and that followed by Leon Trotsky on the other. Trotsky argued, as many liberals argued, that the revolution in Russia was not the socialist revolution. Trotsky argued you could not go from a peasant society, just as Marx has said, to an advanced, affluent, collectively organized system. Trotsky argued the Russian Revolution was what he called a revolution betrayed. It was betrayed because it could not become an international revolution. Ever afterwards, there was a division between Trotskyism on the one hand, which looked for international revolution, and Marxist-Leninism, or the form of Marxism that emerged in the Soviet Union on the other. These are massively red historical questions when you consider the subsequent fate of the Soviet Union. Because by any token, the Soviet Union became an authoritarian society. By any token, it became a bureaucratic state. I think by any token, Marxism itself became an ideology of domination within the Soviet Union. It was not, I didn't think it would be possible for an outsider to pretend anything like the kind of socialist society that Marx anticipated. But what happened in Russia was to happen across the world, because what Marx thought would be the sparking point of revolution actually proved to be the main motive power of revolution through the world. Revolutions did not occur and will now never occur in Western Europe or the United States. The revolutions occurred in peasant societies. Revolutions occurred in China, in Cuba, in some African countries, in other far Asian countries, all peasant societies, not industrial societies. In all those contexts, they produced authoritarian, and one has to say barbaric, systems built in Marx's name. Rather important question, therefore, one has to ask of socialism and of Marxism is what all this means. Were these authoritarian tendencies built into socialism? Was socialism, especially revolutionary socialism, always a doomed enterprise? Is authoritarianism sort of an intrinsic part of what it means to have a command economy? Therefore, is the only alternative an open market society? Because if the only alternative is an open market society, a market society produces many of the things that Marx quite accurately predicted. Big inequalities between rich and poor, now operating on a global level. Big fluctuations, enormous sort of yawning from prosperity to depression. A world in which many people are doing unappetizing jobs. A world in which, certainly within the economic system, there is a good deal of obvious oppression. A world which simply does not listen to the sigh of the oppressed creature, because it is a world simply dominated by economic considerations. These are questions that I'll go on to consider now, 2 weeks from now and next term. Thanks very much for coming today.